The war is now progressing in our favor. Troops are being shifted around. The war is still on, however. And Hitler is trying to get his forces back into Germany because he's on the short end. But that's another story. In this aspect, that is the setting. We were shifted from Morocco, which is in North Africa, to England, Great Britain, England, to a field that had been occupied by the, 81st or the 82nd Airborne, whichever, you might check that for numbers. 81-82 question mark. You can look that up. Now, they were the people who parachuted into Germany. And they were the people who were towed into Germany over with gliders. Are you familiar with that glider towing? Okay. Yeah, the DC-3, which is a C-47, would tow a glider, which had a fuselage like an airplane, and I don't know how many men it carried, something in the order of 20. And one guy was pilot. And at a given point, they pulled the toggle, released the tow line, and the pilot of the towed plane would land it in the field. The British eventually put big poles in the field, like telephone poles, so you couldn't land it. You smashed up. Well, anyhow, we're now in England. We're operating naturally 7 days a week. And the it was a Sunday. I remember well, because I'd gotten letters from home saying that one of the local boys who was in the army was homesick in, at Bournemouth. So being Sunday, I said, okay, I'll go up to Bournemouth and see how he's doing. That's another story. They said, he's not here, he's in London. He was no more homesick than I was. Anyhow, that's how I know it was Sunday. The clouds were down low. Now, when you come in from the English Channel to England, onto the island of itself, you have a lot of not high mountains, but 2,000 or 3,000 feet, that's all. And usually on a cloudy day, when you're getting when you have the dew point and fog is forming, the clouds will rest on the ground underneath. And many pilots would fly in between the cloud and the land because they could see the distinction from one another. But every now and then they'd miss the fact that on the other side of this little hump, there's a big one. That was called contour flying. Guys had cracked up doing that. And it was a definitely no, you don't come in from the channel on contour. So I came back from Bournemouth, and the field was socked in, very low. It was all, you could see the runway, but it had no ceiling. Our planes were marked with big alphabetical letters on them. And I saw one of my planes come in with a big B on the tail, B for Baker. Well, I knew each crew. In my orders, in my management, I always kept the same crew in the same airplane. That was part of my management technique. I had ground crews assigned to each to a particular airplane. And they were inseparable, inseparable. So when I saw this Beaufort Baker, I knew it was Donahue. Donahue was a fairly good pilot, but he was never, I think he was standing behind a door when they passed out brains. He wasn't too smart in many, his judgment was not what it should be, but as a pilot, he had pretty good ability. I immediately went to the operations and I said, why did Beaufort Baker, oh, he touched down on the field, went right back up into the clouds, gave it the gun and went right back up. Oh, well, who that crazy so-and-so? Went to operations, said why, I asked why did Beaufort Baker go back up into the clouds? They said he came in illegally, he came in contour flying because you were supposed to make contact before you made your final trip from the channel. He came in illegally, so we sent him up to wait his turn. That's real smart. You have to be a rocket scientist to figure that one out. And I said, well, look, why didn't you keep him on the ground if he's a menace to navigation? We can handle him later, but don't send him back up with other airplanes. So where are you going to send him? They said, we don't know. I said, well, what field's open? We don't know. We're trying to find out. Ultimately, it turned out that the closest open fields were in Scotland and Ireland. They're out in the ocean, you know, if you know your geography. All pretty close, but nevertheless, out in the ocean. I had other planes who were out, and I knew that by now they'd be coming back in. They'd be low on fuel, at least they weren't prepared for an alternate field. They were to a degree, but not planned on them. So as a Gibraltar, I said to the duty officer who gave me this explanation, I was talking with him, I said, well, why don't you bring him in on with radar? Now, radar for flight guidance had not yet been invented. It was invented by the Philco radio people who invented or at least made the radars for these planes. And they were units that you could take out of the plane. So what they did, one in Morocco and the other one in England, Philco reps, had made these little, on bomb trailer, four-wheel bomb trailer, put the spare unit, and found out that they could talk to you and observe you flying through the sky. At first they used that for approach, but later on they refined that to give you a precision approach where they could tell you within a couple of feet of how high you were. But we didn't have that yet. In Morocco, when the tech rep down there came to me in my office and said, this is what we have, and this is what we can do, would you like to try it? I said, yes. So we went out, and I got under the hood flying on the instruments with my co-pilot sitting in the next seat, safety lookouts. I was so amazed with what could be done. Because in Morocco, we had a lot of fog also. Pretty much like California. You got the cold ocean, you got the hills, you got the desert, and that warm air with moisture hits the cold air from the ocean, you got fog. So I was so impressed that I made it squadron policy that every landing hereafter would be made on radar if radar was available. We didn't call it anything except radar. Later on, they call it a GCA, ground control approach. And that's another story. Because the airlines wouldn't accept it at first. The airlines said, we're not going to have somebody on the ground who's not an aviator telling us how to come in. So let me digress on that point and bring me back to where we were later. As late as 1947, airline pilots refused to use this new system. The new system existed only on Navy bases. So I was on my way to Dayton, Ohio, and I had plenty of fuel to get there, plenty of fuel to go to an alternate. I went to Dayton, and Dayton was socked in. They didn't have a GCA there. So I went back to Columbus, Ohio, where I could get fuel, and I knew they had GCA. And I came down and on GCA. It was almost totally socked in, well below range minimums, which was your limit. The Skyline lower than that, you couldn't land that airport. That's why I didn't land at Wright-Patterson Field. As I taxied up to the Navy hangar, I saw at the municipal hangar a commercial plane taxiing in. Now remember, the airline pilots refused to use it. They didn't want a non-aviator talking them in. So I said, how did he get in? We're below minimums. They said on GCA. I said, no, Todd, you know they aren't using it. Yeah, but we got an understanding here. They know we have GCA. There's nobody on the ground that can really tell them not to do it unless it was socked in. They said, when they come in, whether it's a Navy plane or not, the GCA monitors them, monitors all flights coming in. They don't say anything as long as things are going all right. But if he gets into trouble, they tell him and he flies off. They knew that that was the ground rule in Columbus, Ohio. Okay, so I gassed up and took off later on. Now, where were we when I digressed?
Coming in on radar in Morocco.
Okay. So in Morocco, all of my pilots were required to use it, except an emergency, if Philco had it out there using it, manning it. So when I left to England, and I saw what Beaver Baker did, I said, why don't you bring him in on radar? And they said, well, we don't use radar. We only use it for training, but we don't use it an actual situation. And I said, well, my planes are all trained. He says, I'm sorry, sir, but that's our policy. So I said, well, who's the senior officer here? He said, I am, sir, which is all right. I said, you were. Bring me your logbook, I'll relieve you. Because I got three stripes, he's only got two. I don't think many people know that among the Allies, we honored the rank of each country, so it didn't matter where you're from, your rank still held. So it was not unusual for me to give a command to a Britisher. He brought me the logbook, and I made the proper entry, and I said, all right, now, follow my instructions. In those days, they had direction finding at the station. No beacons, you had radio silence because of the enemy. I said, contact the plane, or if he contacts you for the conditions at the field, you tell him to shift over to the VHF, very high frequency. And then have the VHF give him a bearing to bring him over the VHF, because the VHF can take a bearing. When he gets over the station, turn them over to your radar, and you bring them in. In the meantime, I told my duty officers, contact the other squadrons, tell them what I'm doing, see if they want airplanes brought in. Unfortunately, they came back, so the skipper's on here, not here, we don't know. And I said, you tell them when my plane's in, I'm shutting down if I don't get a yes. So anyway, I brought in some four or five planes. And Monday morning, my group commander said, I think you're in trouble. I said, for what? And he showed me a message that the group commander at the other field, these fields were side by side, the group commander at the other field, who was senior to mine, had sent a message to the commodore down in Plymouth, England, saying what I had done and strongly recommending disciplinary action for me. So I said, and he says, I think they're going to eat you out. I said, I don't care. I got my planes in. I said, you know where their planes are? He said, yeah, they're in Ireland, Scotland. In fact, they didn't get out for a week, which made it even worse. I was the only guy flying missions for a week. So we went to the senior group commander's office, and all my buddies went through flight training. We were buddies. They won't talk to me. They're mad. It's not my fault they were away on a Sunday. So we sat in the office for about an hour. Every 15 minutes, the yeoman would come out. That's your male stenographer. The captain's the secretary. He said, the group commander's on the telephone. He'll be soon. He kept about three or four of these, and pretty soon the group commander came out himself. He said, sorry, hold you up, gentlemen. He said, but we're not going to have a conference. What? I expect you to shoot out and no conference? So my group commander says, I'll find out what happened. It turns out that when the commodore in Plymouth got the message from the senior group commander, he picked up the telephone and called the group commander. The commodore called the group commander and ate him out by saying, what are you doing up there? It's your job, not a squadron, the commander. So he ate him out for not taking charge. Well, I thought maybe that would be the end, but it was only the beginning. A month or two later, there was some sort of a VIP party down in Plymouth, where the admirals and the vice admirals and the air marshals and the lowest grade people were squadron commanders. And as I was introduced to these various British flag officers, almost unanimously, all the same, Paranac, Paranac, where have we heard that name before? Oh, you're the chap who took over our airfield. And I'd say with proper deference, I said, that's correct, Admiral. And under the same conditions, I'm afraid to say I'd have to do it again. Later on, as the war is over, all the other squadron commanders got a British decoration, but I didn't. So that takes care of the British. In a manner. Nothing ever takes care of the British.